Yes, sir.
Joseph Horlock, the foreman of the jury, asked, What day was it that you first talked about the coughing signal and killing your mother?
It was on the Sunday, said Natty.
Did you ever ask your brother not to kill your mother? Asked Lewis.
Yes, once I asked him not to do it.
When was that?
I don't know.
Was it before the Saturday, before your father went away?
It was before he came home.
The boy's father had returned from his previous voyage on the SS France on Monday, 24 June, the day before Robert gave in his notice at Thames Ironworks. This suggested that the brothers had discussed the murder plan in the fortnight that Robert was employed at the iron yard. Did you ask him not to kill her before the knife was put up the chimney in your bedroom?
No, I said nothing to him.
Detective Inspector Mellish showed the jury the suit that Fox had been wearing when arrested. Inspector Gilbert produced the boy's nightshirt that had been found hanging on a line in the kitchen. It was lightly spattered with blood. Lewis addressed the 12 members of the jury before inviting them to reach a verdict. This case is one of the most revolting, heartless, and unnatural ever presented to a jury, he said. He told them that their chief responsibility was to establish the cause of death, a matter on which Dr. Kennedy had been very clear. Not only was there one stab which went through the heart, said Lewis, but two, and the knife produced was found on the bed. Yet, he reminded the jurymen, they also had the power to name the suspected perpetrator or perpetrators of Emily Coombs's murder and to commit him or them for trial. They would almost certainly name Robert, since he had made a confession. The question was whether they would also commit Fox or Natty. Lewis acknowledged that the Treasury had withdrawn the case against Natty, but told the jury that this should not prevent them from naming him if they thought he was implicated in the crime. If the jury should be of opinion that he had knowledge of what was going to be done, and the purpose of it, he would be an accessory before the fact, and as such be liable with the principal. If Natty knew why the knife had been bought, Lewis explained, he was, according to the law, guilty along with the person who made the purchase. He clarified the definition of an accessory before the fact. This was someone who, even if he was not present at the crime, had procured, counselled, commanded, or abetted another person to commit the felony. However, said Lewis, he could not be an accessory if he had countermanded anything that had been said. Lewis's keen questioning of Natty on the matter of whether and when he had discouraged Robert from killing their mother was intended to untangle this issue. Only if Natty had tried to stop Robert after the purchase of the knife would he be in the clear. The Coombs brothers were young, the coroner observed. But the law says that between 7 years and 14 years an infant is liable and can be charged with felony if the jury is thoroughly well satisfied that he has the capacity to understand good from evil. Therefore, if they are of opinion that one or both of these boys thoroughly understands right from wrong, then they are amenable to the law. The jury did not need to deal with the possibility that John Fox was an accessory after the fact, Lewis said, and should commit him for trial only if they believed that he had been involved in the murder plot. His conduct after the killing fell outside the jurisdiction of the inquest, which dealt with just the death and not its aftermath. The jury retired, and after 1 hour and 10 minutes delivered the verdict towards which the coroner had been guiding them. Willful murder against Robert Allen Coombs, and as an accessory before the fact against Nathaniel, inasmuch as he conspired with his brother Robert to murder his mother, and he never did anything to prevent his brother carrying out the dreadful deed. The foreman, Horlock, commended the police on the manner in which they had conducted the case and offered the jury's condolences to the husband and relatives of Emily Coombs. The jurors signed a document attesting to their verdict, and Lewis sent a certificate to the registrar at Somerset House, giving the cause of Emily Coombs's death as willful murder. The coroner issued a warrant for the rearrest of Nathaniel George Coombs. Natty was taken back into custody and delivered to Holloway by Detective Sergeant Don. He was to remain in jail with his brother and John Fox until the September sessions of the Central Criminal Court at the Old Bailey. Horlock added a rider to the jury's verdict. "We consider that the legislature should take some steps to put a stop to the inflammable and shocking literature that is sold, which in our opinion leads to many a dreadful crime being carried out." "There can't be any difference of opinion about that," said Lewis. In the mid-1890s, the prevalence of penny dreadfuls, as they were known in the press, or penny bloods, as they were known to shopkeepers and schoolboys, was a subject of great public concern. "Tons of this trash is vomited forth from Fleet Street every day," observed the Motherwell Times in March 1895, "and inwardly digested by those whose mental pabulum is on a level with the stuff for which it craves." More than 1 million boys' periodicals were sold a week, most of them to working-class lads who had been taught to read in the state-funded board schools set up over the previous 2 decades. An Act of Parliament of 1870 had given local authorities the power to enforce school attendance, and successive acts made elementary education compulsory in 1880, and then free in 1891. Between 1870 and 1885, the number of children at elementary schools trebled, and by 1892, 4.5 million children were being educated in the board schools. The new wave of literate children sought out penny fiction as a diversion from the rote learning and drill of the school curriculum, and then from the repetitive tasks of the mechanized industries to which many of them progressed. Since cheap magazines were traded on street corners, in playgrounds and factory yards, each issue could have many readers. Penny fiction was Britain's first taste of mass-produced popular culture for the young, and was often held responsible for the decay of literature and of morality. The blood sold for a halfpenny, a penny or tuppence, depending on the length of the story, while proper novels for boys, whether Robinson Crusoe or The Prisoner of Zenda, The Romances of Walter Scott or The Adventures of Jules Verne, cost at least 2 or 3 shillings each. Most of Robert's novelettes were 64-page pamphlets priced at tuppence, their titles picked out in scarlet and yellow on vividly illustrated covers. At 8.5 inches tall and 6 inches wide, they were small enough to slip inside a jacket pocket or between the leaves of a textbook or a prayer book. They were sold by newsagents, tobacconists, confectioners, and chandlers. A week after Robert and Natty's arrest, a St. James's Gazette journalist was assigned to analyse the contents of every cheap boy's weekly that he could lay his hands on. He read 36 different titles, some of which, he said, had a circulation of more than 300,000, and he reported on the results over several issues of the newspaper. The task was repulsive and depressing, he said. The writing brutalized my whole consciousness, reviving the fundamental instinct of savagery inherent in us all. It disgusts, but it attracts. As one reads on, the disgust lessens, and the attraction increases. The Coombs boys, he concluded, with their intelligence scientifically developed at the expense of the ratepayers, had been wound up to regard murder as a highly superior kind of luck by a sedulous study of the worst kind of gory fiction and cutthroat newspaper. In fact, most of the books in Robert's collection, though slapdash and hackneyed in style, were not particularly gory. Earlier in the century, penny pamphlets had contained monstrous gothic tales. They were dubbed dreadfuls because they elicited terror. But they now consisted chiefly of detective mysteries, westerns, futuristic fantasies, tales of pirates, highwaymen, hunters, and explorers. The adventure yarns were strikingly manly productions, heavily influenced by Henry Rider Haggard's King Solomon's Mines, 1885, whose hero boasts that there is not a petticoat in the whole history, and Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island, 1883, which according to Arthur Conan Doyle marked the beginning of the modern masculine novel. Many of the stories that Robert read were English reissues of New York dime novels, among them the Jack Wright submarine tale, the Buffalo Bill adventure, a fable about the medieval crusades, and a mystery featuring Joe Phoenix, a hard-boiled Manhattan detective with an astonishing capacity for impersonation and disguise. These stories had their share of alluring women, with full red lips, lithe figures, bright golden hair floating behind them, and of exciting violence. The brave warrior in The Secret of Castle Coucy, or A Legend of the Great Crusade, leaps on his French foe with an axe, and with one tremendous thrust sent the spike between the two blades of the axe right into Gaston's breast, piercing mail shirt and cuirass, and casting the proud knight to the earth, gasping for breath, and uttering groans of irrepressible agony. The detective hero of Cockney Bob's Big Bluff feels a tingling, burning, electric thrill all over his person when he comes upon a crook. The strange and subtle power he possessed was becoming aroused. In his soul there was a mad tumult of fury. The novelist James Joyce, who was born in the same year as Robert Coombs, wrote in his short story, An Encounter, about the cheap adventure tales circulated secretly in Dublin schools. Joyce's narrator recalls how he used to be enthralled by Wild West stories and American detective fiction featuring unkempt, fierce and beautiful girls. The boy's teacher reprimanded his pupils for reading such rubbish, but as soon as the restraining influence of the school was at a distance, the narrator recalls, I began to hunger again for wild sensations, for the escape which these chronicles of disorder alone seemed to offer me. Though he and his friends played at Indians in the streets near his house, he longed for real adventures to happen to myself. But real adventures, I reflected, do not happen to people who remain at home. They must be sought abroad. The boy and a friend skipped school one day to visit the city quays, lured by the big ships in the wide sea. As they rested in a field after watching the commotion at the docks, they were approached by a well-spoken man in a shabby suit who talked to them of literature, Walter Scott and Edward Bulwer Lytton, and of the pleasure of administering warm whippings to boys. Unsettled by their encounter, a real adventure that they had not anticipated, the boys hurried home in time for tea. The Dreadfuls had their defenders. In an article of 1888, Robert Louis Stevenson recalled with rapture how he had been mastered by penny fiction as a boy. I do not know that I ever enjoyed reading more. Yet most commentators were alarmed by the rise of escapist stories for the young. Every month, it seemed, the newspapers reported on children led astray by such yarns. In 1889, two schoolboys aged 11 and 13 absconded from West Ham with a pistol, an old dagger, and a terrier dog, and their parents informed the magistrates that the boys' minds had been turned by reading penny dreadfuls. In 1892, two Dundee runaways, aged 12 and 14, were apprehended in Newport, Wales, in possession of a revolver, 100 ball cartridges, a travelling rug, and a handwritten document, Directions for Skedaddle. Steal the money, go to the station, and get to Glasgow. Get boat for America. On arriving there, go to the Black Hills and dig for gold, build huts and kill buffalo. Live there and make a fortune. In 1893, a Yorkshire boy of 15 stole £25 from his employer, a ship's chandler, and then took the train to London with the intention of sailing for Australia. When he was caught, his father said he had found hidden in the boy's room a novelette entitled The Adventures of the Brave Boy and the Bush Rangers. Inquest juries frequently linked suicide to cheap literature. When a 12-year-old servant boy hanged himself in Brighton in 1892, the jury delivered a verdict of suicide during temporary insanity induced by reading trashy novels. when a 21-year-old farm labourer in Warwickshire shot himself in the head in 1894. The coroner suggested that the 50-penny dreadfuls found in his room had had an unhinging and mesmeric effect upon his mind. The jury was inclined to agree. Deceased committed suicide whilst in an unsound condition of mind, probably produced by reading novelistic literature of a sensational character. Occasionally, penny dreadfuls were associated with murder. In 1888, two 18-year-olds were charged with killing the timekeeper at a sawmill in Tunbridge Wells, Kent. According to the Daily News, the natural depravity of the lads had found a strong stimulus in the penny dreadfuls of one sort or another which were found in their lodgings. One of the accused men, though, said that he had attacked the timekeeper because he had docked his pay by more than 2 shillings. The timekeeper was a master's man, the lad said, and not a friend to the workers. The suspect wrote a letter to a local newspaper and signed it, "Another Whitechapel Murderer," an allusion to the ongoing murder spree by Jack the Ripper in East London. When the case came to trial, the jury was faced with a tangle of possible causes for the crime, as they would be in the Coombs case. Social discontent, financial need or greed, innate depravity, fantasies of violence inspired by fictional or real-life stories. The men were found guilty, and the judge ignored the jury's recommendation to mercy on account of their age. Both were hanged. Some cheap periodicals for boys try to disassociate themselves from the dreadfuls. "No more penny dreadfuls," proclaimed the new Halfpenny Marvel, founded by the publishing magnate Alfred Harmsworth in 1893. "These healthy stories of mystery, adventure, etc., will kill them." The next year Harmsworth produced another halfpenny paper, the jingoistic Union Jack, copies of which were found in the back parlour of 35 Cave Road. "Parents need not fear when they see their children reading the Union Jack," the editor announced. "There will be nothing of the dreadful type in our stories. No tales of boys rifling their employers' cash boxes and making off to foreign lands, or such like highly immoral fiction products." Since 1884, when the vote had been extended to most British men, the press had often pointed out that children raised on penny dreadfuls would grow up to elect the rulers of the nation. Such pamphlets were "the poison which is threatening to destroy the manhood of the democracy," announced the Pall Mall Gazette in 1886. The Quarterly Review went a step further, warning its readers in 1890 that "the class we have made our masters might be transformed by these publications into agents for the overthrow of society." The Penny Bloods gave a frightening intimation of the uses to which the labourers of Britain could put their literacy and newly won power. These fantasies of wealth and adventure might foster ambition, restlessness, defiance, a spirit of insurgency. There was no knowing the consequences of enlarging the minds and dreams of the lower orders. Chapter 8. Here Goes Nothing. In Holloway Jail on Monday, 5 August, Robert became highly agitated. The warders informed George Walker, the prison's medical officer, that the boy was singing, whistling, and being impertinent. Dr. Walker asked that he be brought to him in his office. Robert took a seat at the table and told Walker that he had pains in his head. The doctor asked him if he heard voices. Robert replied that he heard voices saying, "Kill her, kill her," and "Kill her, kill her, and run away." Walker questioned him about how the voices spoke to him. Robert said that they seemed to whisper into his ear. During this interview, Robert explained to Dr. Walker that he had decided to kill his mother because he was afraid that if he did not do so, she would kill Natty. "She had thrown knives at his younger brother," Robert said, "and had often threatened to knock out his brains with a hatchet." It was common for a parent to use physical force to discipline a child. In many households, a cane or a strap hung by the fireplace for this purpose. but Robert was describing assaults that were dangerous and uncontrolled. Natty's complicity in the murder plot appeared to confirm Robert's account of their mother's behaviour. It seemed that Emily Coombs was doting, indulgent, affectionate to her children, but also given to bursts of anger and violent reproof. She switched between surrendering her authority and enforcing it with abandon. She frightened her sons. On Saturday, Robert was frenzied again, to such an extent that he was moved to a padded room in the infirmary for several hours. Most prisons were equipped with such cells, cushioned with horsehair and leather, to contain epileptic, insane or suicidal inmates. The afternoon was humid, but the night was broken by an hour and a half of thunder and lightning, and then the rain came down in torrents. On Sunday, Robert was calmer, and he was returned to his normal quarters. One of the more gruesome stories in Robert's collection of Penny Bloods featured a wild-eyed loon. In The Rock Rider, or The Spirit of the Sierra, an American cavalry officer called Beckford loses his wits after his wife is killed and his daughter abducted by a posse of Red Indians. For many years afterwards, he lives in a cave in the mountains of the Midwest. From time to time, he hears voices in his head telling him, "Ride, ride, blood comes," at which he snaps into the white heat of fury all at once and becomes the maniac all over. Blazing with hatred, Captain Beckford strikes out on his mule to slaughter Indians, carrying a shield over which he has stretched the mummified face of his wife, as menacing as the Gorgon Medusa. It is pinched and white, with wide-open staring eyes and teeth revealed by parted lips. Beckford kills and decapitates Indians. He hoards their heads in a cave in the mountains, which is watched over by his negro sidekick, Cato. "'Tis thy place to guard the cavern of death,' Beckford tells Cato. "'Tis mine to bring in the victims, for I am the avenger of innocent blood.' Cato is terrified by the cave. "'Don't make me go in, dar, sir,' he pleads. "'De heads de groan, and de devil he be at work at dem.' The whites and the Indians in the Rock Rider are fighting over the land of the Midwest, an erotic landscape of clefts, craters and recesses, wild vines and jutting mountains, hollows and pools. Much as they defend the terrain they have conquered, the white men are determined to preserve the purity of their women, whom they would rather destroy than see taken and defiled by the red niggers. Towards the end of the story, a dashing Frenchman rescues Beckford's kidnapped daughter Blanche from an Indian camp in a haunted gorge. He is dressed in gleaming thigh-high boots with silver spurs, white corduroy trousers, a slashed and braided velvet jacket. Blanche wears a short, tight tunic. "Sooner than give you back alive," the French dandy promises her, "I will blow out your brains with my own hands." By the deranged chivalric code of the Penny Dreadfuls, to kill a woman could be the means of saving her honour, a murder preempted and mimicked, a rape. Robert and Natty's father spent a week in New York while the France was prepared for the return trip. It took several days for the dockhands to fuel the steamer, carrying coal alongside by barge and hoisting it up to the deck in buckets. At the company office near the pier, Coombs hired 15 itinerant workers to look after the cargo of cattle on the journey back to England. These cowboys of the sea would be given free passage both ways across the Atlantic, with 11 shillings to cover their board and lodging in the 10 days or so that the ship was docked in London. Several hundred head of cattle, captured on the plains of the American West and carried to New York by train, were herded up a narrow gangplank and into pens between decks. When the ship cast off on Saturday, 27 July, the cows stumbled and slipped in their pens until they learned to sway with the roll of the ship. At night, some of the cattlemen patrolled the vessel with lanterns. Others rose at 5 to feed and water the animals. They sluiced the decks, pitched manure into the ocean, fetched hay, desalinated buckets of seawater for the cows to drink. The France sailed into the Thames estuary on Saturday, 10 August. the day that Robert became wild in Holloway. The cattle bellowed with excitement, sensing that land was near. From the mouth of the Thames, wrote Joseph Conrad, London appeared in the distance as a brooding gloom in sunshine, a lurid glare under the stars. The river was busy with craft, barges, skips, yachts, tugs, lighters, steamers, and as the ship sailed into the city, the factories and warehouses reared up on either side. The river runs as between high walls, wrote Ford Madox Hoefer, shining with a more metallic glitter under smoke and the shadow of groves of masts, crane arms, chains, cordage. On Sunday, the France docked at Deptford, on the south bank of the Thames. The cows were released from their pens and driven by the cattlemen down a gangway to the pier and then into a shed to be slaughtered. Coombs headed to Holloway to see his sons. That morning at Westminster Abbey, Canon Basil Wilberforce delivered a sermon in which he contrasted the villainy of the West Ham boy murderers with the heroism of the East Ham sewage workers who had given their lives in their efforts to save one another. Yet he urged compassion for the Coombs brothers. Like the French alienists, he attributed the murder to a physiological flaw that affected both boys. The pleistomatricide, said Wilberforce, was clearly the result of hereditary madness. He asked the congregation not to think of the brothers as children of the devil, but instead to remember that they possessed a deep, inmost God nature, which is ever present in man, however much it might be concealed. The master cooper John Lawrence was raising money by subscription to hire a barrister for John Fox in the forthcoming trial. Lawrence explained in his letter to the West Ham Herald why he had such faith in Fox's innocence. During the years of his apprenticeship, Lawrence wrote, he had found Fox at all times to be very truthful, honest, civil, and industrious, in fact, all that an employer would desire both morally and physically. But his mental capacity was far inferior to any of the children who were his chosen and only associates. Fox had sometimes caused him great annoyance, said Lawrence, but he had nonetheless always been to me an object of pity. John William Fox was born to an unmarried, illiterate woman in a dingy courtyard opposite the Leadenhall Poultry Market in the City of London in April 1850. His mother was unable to support him, so when John was 9, the city's Board of Guardians sent him to its industrial school in West London. The 800 children at the school were housed in large dormitories. They spent half of their time at schoolwork and half labouring on the estate. Fox was due to be transferred at the age of 16 to the City of London workhouse, where he would continue to be maintained at the ratepayers' expense, but the board managed to find him a position as an apprentice instead. He was indentured to John Lawrence in the summer of 1866, his parish providing £50 to contribute to his board and lodging over the next 7 years. Fox remained with Lawrence for the full term of the apprenticeship, living with him and his wife and daughter in their house in the Holloway Road. In the 1870s, Fox left the Lawrences and moved east to West Ham. There was plenty of work in the district for coopers, who made and repaired barrels for the docks, the breweries and the sugar refineries, but he began to take jobs on the ships. Fox became a servant to captains. He was paid just over £1 for each voyage, and then an assistant steward with the National Line, working for a time under Robert and Natty's father. He performed menial duties, cleaning and cooking for the officers and crew, and earned about £3 per voyage, less than half of the amount paid to the chief steward, and £1 less than the ordinary sailors. Between trips, he lodged in a carpenter's house in Canning Town. In the summer of 1890, Fox was one of 95 men aboard the Egypt, the largest of the National Line steamships, as it crossed the Atlantic from New York to Liverpool with a cargo of cattle and cotton. On 17 July, a fire broke out in the ship's hold. All the men on board worked furiously to douse the burning cotton bales with hoses and jets of steam, while the 600 cows tied up on the decks hollered in pain as the flames licked at them. Eventually, the master told his men to abandon ship. The sailors were lowered into the water in 6 lifeboats. They rowed away, and after a quarter of a mile stopped to look back. They saw the mainsail fall blazing into the ship's heart. Some of the cows broke free of their halters and leaped away from the flames into the sea, then struggled to swim clear of the burning vessel. The oarsmen rowed hard to avoid being capsized by the terrified, thrashing creatures. A passing ship saw the distress signal set off by the Egypt's bosun and sailed to the rescue of the men in the lifeboats. Once the sailors had been lifted to safety, the captain's wife tended to their burns. For hours afterwards, the men occasionally spotted a cow beating its legs against the water until it gave up the fight and surrendered to the sea. The rescued sailors were conscious of their luck. 6 months earlier, the National Line steamship Erin, on which Fox had also once served, had vanished in the middle of the Atlantic with 527 head of cattle and 74 men. The 2 disasters wiped out the National Line's reserve funds. John Fox had been badly burnt in the fight to put out the Egypt's fire. He was so shaken by his experience that he developed a stutter and a horror of the open sea. He did not serve on a ship again. In August 1895, John Lawrence visited his former apprentice in prison and forwarded a transcript of their conversation to the Evening News. "How came you to be in the house with the boys Coombs for days after they killed their mother?" asked Lawrence in the interview, published on 13 August. "They came and fetched me from the ship," said Fox. "How came you to be wearing their father's clothes?" "Robert Coombs said they were a misfit," said Fox, "and his mother told him to give them to me." Lawrence asked him what share of the money from the pawnbrokers Robert had given to him. "He did not give me any share at all," said Fox. "He gave me nothing." "But surely if you gave him all the money, he gave you some back." "No, not a penny." "Is it true that you went with a letter to Mr. Hewson containing an application for money?" "Yes. Robert told me to take it, and I did." "Did he read the note to you, or give it to you open?" "No, he did not read it to me, and he fastened it up." "How, then, did you know that it contained an application for money?" "Well, I supposed so, because he told me to wait and bring some money back." "Did you not smell something very disagreeable?" "No, nothing at all," said Fox. "My smell is not very good, and they must have opened the windows upstairs to let the smell out. Oh, they are 2 very wicked boys." Lawrence asked him to explain how Mrs. Coombs's purse came to be found in his pocket. "I put it there myself. Robert Coombs gave me that and a shilling at the same time, and that was the only money he gave me all the time I was there." Fox was apparently contradicting himself on the issue of whether Robert had given him any money, but this seemed a sign of confusion rather than dishonesty. Lawrence asked him if he would have stayed in the house if he had known what had been done to Emily Coombs. "Oh, no," said Fox. "I would have run out of the house as fast as I could. I would not have stayed there if I had known it for 1,000 pounds. The polling for the general election had concluded on 7 August with a Conservative victory. Lord Salisbury was appointed Prime Minister. The new Home Secretary, Sir Matthew White Ridley, Bart, almost immediately addressed the matter of the penny dreadfuls. He told the House of Commons on 16 August that there was little prospect of restricting the publication of such works, as a Home Office inquiry of 1888 had been unable to demonstrate a connection between cheap books and juvenile crime. Under existing laws, only publications that were blasphemous, obscene, or seditious could be banned. It was no wonder that the violence in the penny dreadfuls was so often eroticized, since this was a means for writers to invoke sex without falling foul of the obscenity law. though the government declared itself powerless to act against the dreadfuls, the press continued to make a connection between the Coombs boys' books and their crime. The Leeds Times surmised that the brothers had lived in a world of hallucination, their brains addled by the cheap and fantastical stories that they kept in the back parlour. Confusing the real and the imaginary, they had begun to look on daggers as lead pencils, quite as harmless and innocent in making their mark. In an editorial on the case, the medical journal The Lancet explained the process by which the dreadfuls could foster violence. "People of a lower evolutionary type," the journal said, "had an ape-like tendency to imitation. If exposed to stories of suicide or murder, degenerate individuals might be impelled to act them out." "Penny dreadfuls again," ran the headline in several papers, when a 15-year-old errand boy stole a metal clock in London in mid-August. The mother of the boy said that his behaviour had been exemplary until he started to read such stories. All he wanted now was to go to sea and read books about pirates. The magistrate looked over the samples of literature with which the mother presented the court and shook his head ominously. The journalist Hugh Chisholm suggested that the outcry over the Penny Dreadfuls was especially marked because the Coombs crime had come so soon after the exposure of the abominable crimes of Oscar Wilde, a purveyor of non-moral literature for the upper circles of the literary world. Wilde was in prison in Wandsworth, South London, having been convicted in May on 25 counts of gross indecency. "The Dreadfuls," said Chisholm, "were the lower-class equivalent of Wilde's decadent productions." Yet it remained impossible to prove a pattern of cause and effect. Penny dreadfuls were continually being discovered in the bedrooms and pockets of young criminals and suicides, but perhaps only because they were in the bedrooms and pockets of most boys in Britain. In August, a group of about 20 boys at a northwest London board school signed a petition to the newly assembled House of Commons that begged the politicians not to issue a ban. "We read that some people who are too old to care about adventures put all the murders down to reading these tales," they wrote. "We do not think there is any truth in all this, and we hope you won't suppress any of the following papers." The boys appended a list of their favourite journals. The Home Office turned its attention to the welfare of the Coombs brothers. There were already rumours that Natty had threatened suicide, and now Robert had become deranged enough to be locked in a padded cell. The Lancet, in its editorial on the Coombs case, referred to the epidemic of suicide in Britain, which was especially marked among the young. The Sunday paper, The People, reported that the number of suicides in London in the past month had far exceeded the figure for July 1894 and included at least five victims who were younger than 18. "The peculiar state of the atmosphere in consequence of the excessive heat has been considered to have been the cause in many cases." The Home Secretary told the Governor of Holloway that the Coombs boys should be kept under strict observation by the medical officer and the chaplain. They should be housed in the prison infirmary, given plenty of exercise, and kept away from other inmates. Earlier in the century, childhood had been prized as a time of purity and innocence. But by the 1890s, darker interpretations prevailed. To those influenced by the theories of Lombroso, children were quintessentially base, not so much unblemished as primeval. "The child is, naturally, by his organization, nearer to the animal, to the savage, to the criminal, than the adult," wrote Havelock Ellis in The Criminal, 1890. "Children are naturally egoists. They will commit all enormities, sometimes to enlarge their egoistic satisfaction." The celebrated psychiatrist James Crichton Browne in 1883 urged parents to remember that children are not little 19th-century men and women, but diamond editions of very remote ancestors, full of savage whims and impulses and savage rudiments of virtue. Henry Maudsley, the other pre-eminent psychiatrist of the age, wrote in 1895, "Whoever observes sincerely what a child's actual mind is, without being biased by preconceived notions of its primal purity, innocence, and natural inclination to good, must see and own that its proclivities are not to good but to evil, and that the impulses which move it are the selfish impulses of passion. Give an infant in arms power in its limbs equal to its passions, and it would be more dangerous than any wild beast." But the psychologist James Sully, an early researcher into child development, took a different view. Sully held that children were complex and vulnerable creatures whose treatment by adults was decisive in forming their characters and fate. "A child was not yet a moral being," said Sully in 1895, "and there is a certain impertinence in trying to force it under our categories of good and bad, pure and corrupt." He observed that the young confused fact and fiction because to them, words are not dead thought symbols, but truly alive. Children often could not articulate their fears, even to themselves, and this only made those fears the more intense. How carefully are they wont to hide from our sight their nameless terrors, physical and moral? Much of the deeper childish experience can only reach us, if at all, years after it is over, through the faulty medium of adult memory. Robert and Natty's father visited the boys in Holloway jail frequently, 14 times in 4 weeks, he said, and he remained in London when the SS France sailed for New York on 19 August. The chief steward of the Spain took his place on the ship. In early September, Coombs gave an interview to the Evening News in which he outlined the plans for his son's defence. Robert would be defended on the grounds of insanity, Natty on the grounds that he was wholly under Robert's influence. This was the narrative that Coombs had established when interviewed by the newspaper men in New York, before even speaking to his sons or the police. Robert was the leader and Natty the follower. Robert was warped and Natty was impressionable. Yet the boys' schoolteachers and neighbours made no such distinction. They characterised both brothers as quick-witted, competent lads. If either was naughty, it was Natty who, according to Mary Jane Burridge, cheeked his mother and stole her food. By his own account, Natty had gone along with the killing and its cover-up, and afterwards it was he who seemed the most alive to the danger they faced. He hovered in the background when they encountered adults. He fled when their Aunt Emily entered the house. Many commentators at first accepted that Natty had encouraged Robert's murder plan, but their father firmly steered the story so that the boys and their fates were divided. Within days of the New York interviews, the Treasury had asked Bagley to discharge Natty so that he could be called as a witness. Coombs was shrewd to focus on saving the son who might plausibly be saved, but his strategy entailed turning one brother against the other and leaving Robert to bear the consequences of the killing alone. Coombs did not repeat his allegation that he had banned Fox from the house, nor Captain Hadley's story about Fox lurking in a gangway with a knife. Now that he was back in England, he saw that it was hopeless to try to pin the blame for the killing on Fox. There was no evidence that the man had any prior knowledge of the murder, and the worst that the police or the newspapers had been able to dredge up about him was that he once had been charged as a suspected person after being found in an East End railway station late at night. He might be convicted of helping to conceal the crime, but this would do nothing to exculpate Robert or Natty. Coombs told the Evening News that his eldest son had always been a most humane child, but was strongly drawn to morbid subjects. On his most recent visit to see his boys, he said, Robert appeared to have returned to his better self. He was much affected by the fact of the murder, and expressed wonder that he could have killed his mother. Robert seemed bewildered, unable to fathom what he had done. Both his father and Dr. Walker saw signs in him of anxiety and distress. On Monday, 9 September, the September sessions opened at the Old Bailey. The Common Sergeant, Sir Forrest Fulton, addressed the grand jury that had been assembled to grant the cases on the roster a true bill and so enable them to proceed to trial. Fulton remarked on the great number of cases before the jury, 183 to be heard in the four courts over 10 days, and the unusual gravity of many of them. There was always a build-up of charges over the 6-week summer break, said Fulton, but he could not remember a heavier calendar than this, nor could he remember a case of greater cruelty and heartlessness than the first that they were to consider, the murder of Emily Harrison Coombs. He told the jury that Nathaniel George Coombs would not be tried, despite having been charged under the coroner's inquisition, but would instead be called as a witness for the Crown. John Fox would be indicted as an accessory after the fact. That is, he would be charged with having known of the crime and assisted in concealing it. Robert Allen Coombs would be charged with murder. In Holloway on Tuesday, Fox, Natty and Robert learnt that the grand jury had returned true bills and that the trial might be held as early as Wednesday, when a judge of the Queen's Bench would come to the Old Bailey to hear the session's most serious cases. Natty was informed that he would appear as a witness rather than a defendant, but would go into the dock with the others. Robert knew for certain now that he would face the murder charge alone, and that his brother's testimony might help to convict him. Dr. Walker talked to Robert that day about the forthcoming trial. The boy at first seemed gleeful at the prospect of going to the Old Bailey, telling the doctor that it would be a splendid sight, and he was looking forward to it. He would wear his best clothes, he said, and have his boots well polished. He started to talk about his cats, and then suddenly fell silent. A moment later he burst into tears. Dr. Walker asked him why he was crying.
"Because I want my cats," said Robert, "and my mandolin."
On Wednesday, Justice Kennedy of the Queen's Bench went from the Royal Courts of Justice to take a seat in the old court of the Old Bailey. He announced that he did not intend to hear the Coombs case that day, but would appoint any other day that suited counsel in the case. One of the prosecutors suggested Friday, and Kennedy agreed. He confirmed that the charge against Natty was being withdrawn. Kennedy proceeded to hear two other cases on Wednesday, a fatal assault and a child rape, and two on Thursday, a woman charged with neglecting a baby who had died in her care, and a man accused of the manslaughter of his wife. Friday and Saturday came and went without the Coombs trial being heard. Instead, Kennedy dealt with a fishmonger's assistant who had accidentally killed another man in a fight about a woman, an American lawyer who had tried to blackmail a Dorset rector, a soldier who had shot at a woman who turned down his advances, and a 13-year-old servant girl accused of starting fires in her mistress's house. The jury was unable to reach a verdict on this last case. They were dismissed and a fresh jury appointed. Fox and Robert learnt that their trial would be held on Monday. Remand prisoners were entitled to send a letter a day posted at the government's expense. And on Saturday, 14 September, Robert wrote to the Reverend Francis Shaw, a curate at a mission church off the Barking Road. The Coombs family went regularly to church. They were among only a fifth of Londoners to do so. And Robert and Natty also attended Sunday school. It was said that the boys had been to church with John Fox, even on the Sunday after the murder. According to the interview their father gave to the Evening News, Robert was a great favourite of the Reverend Shaw, and the curate had recently prepared the boy for confirmation. Coombs said that Shaw had offered to give evidence on Robert's behalf at the Old Bailey. Francis Longsdon Shaw was the youngest son of a Derbyshire corn merchant. His mother had died in 1872 when he was a baby, and he was sent to board at a vicarage in Staffordshire. At the age of 10, he had an epiphany during a mission service on a beach in the Welsh resort of Llandudno. 7 years later, he was admitted to Trinity College, Cambridge, to read theology, and in May 1894, He was licensed to the curacy at St. Andrew's, at the Plaistow end of the Barking Road. St. Andrew's was a highly ceremonial church, known for its promotion of English plainsong. The parish had grown so dramatically since the church was built in 1870 that two of its curates, Shaw, who was 23, and Alan Hay, another Cambridge graduate, were deputed to establish a mission a little further up the Barking Road. They raised funds by staging benefits in the parish hall. One featured a mandolinist called Miss Hapney and a ventriloquist and necromancist known as Signor Ralpho, and were able to open St. Martin's Mission in the summer of 1894. The Reverends Shaw and Hay had eschewed comfortable livings in the hope of bringing spiritual and practical relief to this deprived neighbourhood. They organised magic lantern shows for the local children, and they lived among their flock, lodging in ordinary terraced houses near the mission. Shaw was the most highly educated man that Robert Coombs knew. Robert addressed his letter to the Reverend Mr. Shaw at 583 Barking Road. "Dear Mr. Shaw," he wrote, "I received your letter on last Tuesday. I think I will get hung, but I don't cares as long as I get a good breakfast before they hang me. If they don't hang me, I think I will commit suicide. That will do just as well. I will strangle myself. I hope you are all well. I go up on Monday to the Old Bailey to be tried. I hope you will be there. I think they will sentence me to death, and if they do, I will call all the witnesses liars. I remain your affectionate friend, R. A. Coombs." Robert had drawn two pictures on the letter. The first, captioned "Scene 1, Going to the Scaffold," was a sketch of three figures making their way towards a gallows, with the word "Executioner" written above the first figure. The second figure, presumably, was Robert, and the third may have represented Fox, though he did not face a capital charge, or Natty, though he faced no charges at all. Beneath this drawing, Robert wrote, "Will, to Dr. Walker, £3,000, to Mr. Hay, £2,000, to Mr. Shaw, £5,000, to my father, £60,000, to each of the warders, £300. The second picture was entitled "Scene 2, Hanging." It showed a body suspended by the neck from a gallows, with a hand pulling the rope, and a message issuing from the mouth of the dangling figure. "Goodbye, here goes nothing. P.S. Excuse the crooked scaffold. I was too heavy, so I bent it. I leave you £5,000. The letter was skittish, excited, switching between bleakness and gaiety, lightness and weight. Robert seemed full of bravado. He didn't care about death, only breakfast, and defiance. He would kill himself if he was not killed. He would denounce the witnesses as liars if he was convicted. In the captions to the pictures, he was both an airy nothing on the gallows and a being so heavy that he bent the wooden beam. The reference to his weight bending the scaffold was a joke, a piece of gallows humour, about the wobbly line of his drawing. The tone of the letter was unsteadily detached, as if Robert was half allowing and half refusing the sorrow that had started to leak in when he wept in Walker's office about his mandolin and his cats. On the day that he killed his mother, the explanation that Robert had given for her disappearance was that a relative had died and left them money. This was a veiled version of the truth. His mother was the relative who had died, and the boys and their playmate Fox were the inheritors of her wealth. "All I know is that we are rich," he had told his aunt. When Robert predicted his own death in the letter to Shaw, he became the munificent benefactor. As if his love was money, he bestowed his bounty on the men who had shown him kindness, the prison warders, the Plaistow curates, the prison doctor, and most of all, his father. In this fantasy, death was not an absence, but a release of riches. Part 3. These Tender Times. Chapter 9. Cover Her Face. In the morning of Monday, 16 September, Robert, Natty and John Fox were taken from their cells to the yard of Holloway Jail, where they were ushered into the back of a horse-drawn van and fastened into narrow, boxed compartments. A few warders accompanied them on the drive south to Newgate Jail, a four-mile trip that took half an hour. The Black Maria discharged its passengers at Newgate, next to the Old Bailey Law Courts in the City of London. Until 1868, a gallows had stood just outside the prison entrance. Since executions were no longer conducted in public, the gallows were now inside the yard, in a purpose-built shed fitted with a horizontal glass window. If Robert were to be sentenced to death, this was where he would be hanged. The most recent execution here had been that of Paul Cachula, a 24-year-old waiter who had been found guilty of robbing and murdering his boss's wife at a German restaurant in Soho. Dr. Walker of Holloway Jail had been present at the waiter's death. On 14 August 1894, he and the other witnesses had watched from benches in the yard as the hangman placed a noose around Cachula's neck and then pulled a lever to let him drop out of sight through a trapdoor in the ground. The Coombs brothers and John Fox were led from the jail to the Old Bailey courthouse through an underground passage known as Birdcage Walk. The roof of the tunnel was a heavy iron grating. The flagstone floor covered the graves of executed convicts. Shortly after 11 o'clock, the warders guided Robert, Natty and Fox up a small staircase that climbed straight from the Old Bailey basement into the prisoner's dock in the old court. Robert's shirt collar was turned up beneath his tennis blazer, and Natty wore a bow tie. Fox had spruced himself up a little too. His wispy beard had grown fuller and blacker, and he sported a red handkerchief in his breast pocket. Robert seemed to be suppressing laughter as he stepped into the raised and bulwarked dock. "Natty gazed around like a visitor inspecting a new building," said the Star, "with a truly horrible unconcern." Fox's expression was grave, and he trembled visibly as he looked about him. Neither the boys' father nor their Aunt Emily was present, since both were waiting in a chamber reserved for the witnesses. But the 40-foot square courtroom was crammed. The benches to the right of the dock were filled with reporters and newspaper artists, a gallery above the dock with members of the public. In front of the dock, in a well between the defendants and the judge, were the barristers at law, who would defend and prosecute the case, and the solicitors and government officials who had instructed them. The 12 men of the jury sat on benches in a box to the left, beneath three square windows that looked onto the dark granite walls of Newgate. Next to the windows were reflectors to brighten the room, and huge lamps for use when London became dense with fog. The city's pea supers of soot and sulphur were at a peak in the 1890s. Justice William Rann Kennedy, the judge who would conduct the trial, sat with two Old Bailey sheriffs opposite the dock. Behind them hung a crimson curtain and a gilded sword, above them a canopy and a carving of the royal arms. Robert peered over the dock railing at the judge, smiling broadly. Kennedy, who was 49, had smooth, clean-shaven skin, full cheeks, large brown eyes, and a slightly downturned mouth, which gave him a doleful expression. He was well turned out in court, being one of the few lawyers in Westminster to adhere to the old custom of having his wig powdered and done up every morning. Before becoming a judge, he had run a practice in Birkenhead near Liverpool, specialising in maritime and commercial law, and had twice stood unsuccessfully as Liberal candidate in his constituency. Kennedy had been known at Eton and Cambridge as a brilliant classical scholar and linguist, but once appointed to the Queen's Bench in 1892, he proved ponderous, with none of the intellectual sparkle that had marked his academic career. The case against Robert and Fox was to be presented by Charles Gill and Horace Avory, both of whom regularly appeared for the Crown at the Old Bailey. Earlier in the year, the two had prosecuted Oscar Wilde. Famously, Gill had asked Wilde to gloss a line from a poem by his friend Lord Alfred Douglas. "What is the love that dare not speak its name?" "It was the love between an older and a younger man," Wilde replied, "when the older man has intellect and the younger man has all the joy, hope, and glamour of life before him." Gill had also helped convict James Canham Reed, the murderer of Florence Dennis in Chelmsford the previous winter. Gill began by asking for Natty to be discharged. The Crown had decided not to prosecute him, despite the West Ham coroner's belief that he should stand trial, because his evidence might help secure convictions against Robert and Fox. He was clearly less culpable than his brother, and he was the only person who could corroborate or refute the key details of Robert's confession and Fox's account of the aftermath of the crime. After Natty had been removed from the dock, the charges were read out by the Clerk of Arraigns. Kennedy asked Robert how he pleaded to the murder charge. "Guilty," said Robert. His counsel, William Grantham, quickly intervened to inform the judge that Robert's plea was not guilty. "Tell him to say not guilty," said Kennedy. "Not guilty," said Robert with another wide smile. Fox was charged with receiving, comforting, and abetting Robert in the knowledge that he had committed the murder. "Not guilty," said Fox. Just as Gill was about to open the prosecution case, the proceedings were interrupted by an official who wanted to consult Justice Kennedy on a point of law. Kennedy left the room. While the court waited for his return, Fox and Robert were provided with chairs. When Kennedy came back to the bench at noon, Gill rose to his feet again and ran through the facts of the case. A handsome man of 43, Gill was one of the finest advocates of his generation. His preparation for trials was thorough and intelligent, his manner in court unshowy, persuasive, and scrupulously fair. His only mannerism was to remove his spectacles for emphasis, whether to signal surprise, doubt, indignation, or encouragement. He was suspected of a lurking sympathy for many of the defendants he prosecuted. The court fell silent when Gill began to reprise the story of the murder. Robert smiled and looked over attentively.